Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and illusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. David Ayoub. And Dr. Ayoub is a radiologist practicing back in the Illinois area, and he has actually had the opportunity to do some fabulous research on the effect of the mercury and vaccines and other products upon the minds of, and going to the background of the idea that the mercury and vaccines had no relationship to creation of autism, was just totally invalid. The government knew how toxic the mercury was and has been concealing that fact, because after all, how could you possibly justify destroying the lives of one in every 65 male children in the United States? Well, then, of course, he did a wonderful talk. We have it here on a DVD. It's called Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda. If you haven't seen it, you should. It's available up on our Internet site. But if you get it through us, get the DVD, well, you'll also get a CD-ROM with a great deal of the research that Dr. Ayoub has done on this subject. But this evening we're going to be talking about a different subject, and he has researched as well, and I think it's vitally important. Of course, we can really talk about whatever he wants to talk about, but good evening, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Dr. Stan. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. So anyway, we're going to talk about aluminum tonight?
Yeah, love to.
All right, fine. Well, aluminum, because they put aluminum in our vaccines. Every time you take a vaccine shot, you get an aluminum shot because they put in alum. It helps to mobilize the immune system, but is that always necessarily a good thing? And what about the cumulative effect of long-term aluminum? So I'm going to let David speak up that thought and let him do the talking from here on out.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I there's a lot of toxins in the world, and you've done a great job having speakers on your shows talk about vaccine safety, and I think the emphasis so far has been mercury and vaccines, which we all know is a toxin. And some people have instigated the MMR vaccine as a trigger for autism. I think there's some pretty good science to that, but I really think that we've been misled a little bit. And the reason I started looking at aluminum, it was kind of coincidence, I suppose. They had taken mercury out of a lot of the childhood vaccines in about 2003, I believe. It was supposed to get out of the early childhood vaccines, the Hep B, DTB, and Hib vaccine. And really there was a lot of hope that the autism rates would drop. But the fact is, and even though there's very few good studies that looked at these rates really since then, it appears that the rates continue to climb. And the doctors that are treating these children with biomedical means that know these are vaccine reactions started saying, you know what, mercury is out, and we're seeing a little bit of a different kind of autism, sort of a gentler form of autism after they took mercury out. We're not seeing less autism, but it just doesn't seem to be quite as severe and profound, and they really were scratching their head thinking, well, is there mercury in trace amounts, or is it environmental mercury, or what's going on? And so that was one of the reasons why I took a look at what are the other constituents in vaccines that could be neurotoxins, and that's how I stumbled upon aluminum.
And I think it's important that people have to understand that all of these metals are certainly bad for us. I mean, whether it be lead, whether it be mercury, whether it be aluminum, so many of the things that, of course, the fluoride has an effect on the brain. It's not a heavy metal, but certainly aluminum would probably not be a heavy metal, but it is a metal. Do metals help us? No, they don't. I mean, they're toxic to us, and I think we have to begin to recognize that, and we're going to see what Dr. Ayoub found here in just a moment when we return. David, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, at several of the meetings I attend every year, I started listening a little more carefully to some of the moms, and I often heard this. They said, you know, when we're getting our hair toxicology profiles, our urine toxicology tests, we're seeing a lot of aluminum, and nobody really, we don't know what it means, but my kid has aluminum. And you hear, I heard that time and time again. And the other thing I think that led me to look at this further, when I visited a nutritionist in southern Illinois, a superb clinician who's been taking care of chronic illness for 25 years, just nutritionally, and we were going over some charts of some interesting cases in his practice, and he said, David, take a look at this kid, and he showed me a kid in elementary school with a hair analysis with aluminum absolutely off the chart. He said, this kid had ADHD, and he showed me another chart, and another chart, and another chart, and it was the same thing. And he said, here's what happened. There was an elementary school where kids were given free Capri Sun drinks, which had aluminum foil containers. We just realized that this was the source of their ADHD when we eliminated these free drinks they were getting because of a local distributor or manufacturer. Their ADHD declined basically the majority of students in one school. So, you know, with that in mind, I went back to these meetings and looked at these kids, and I thought, oh, my goodness. Has anyone ever considered aluminum in the vaccines? So there, I just one of the first things I did really was just looked at the medical literature and tried to find cases of childhood aluminum poisoning from no matter what the source was, what was in the literature already, and what were the features of aluminum poisoning. Was there any resemblance to autism? Or, as you know, these autistic children have a lot of comorbidities. A lot of problems, speech problems, seizure disorders, sleep disorders, immune dysfunction, and so forth. So I was sort of sniffing around to see what was there. And what I found was 85 published reports of children who were exposed to aluminum from various sources. Some kids had renal failure, and that makes it difficult for aluminum to be excreted in the body. But some of these cases do not have renal failure. They were exposed to high doses of antacids, for example. And the symptoms were, I thought, very, very strikingly similar to autism. There wasn't one case report that was flat out described as autism, but most of these studies were in the 1980s. So it was before autism was really on a lot of the radar. You see symptoms in these children, including loss of speech, very common, seizure disorders, something called myoclonus, which is a neurological, it's a muscle, sudden muscle contraction like a tick. A nervous tick, and that's very commonly observed. If you've ever seen an autistic child, very frequently you see ticks.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought just as we bring our stations on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Dr. David Aub, and he had really gotten interested in the aluminum after talking to a nutritionist who showed him the records of a number of children who were ADD, attention deficit disorder type of children, and they all had very, very high levels of aluminum in their hair samples. And then, of course, it was found that they were being given free drinks at the school, and it contaminated with aluminum. And when they took the beverages away from them, the aluminum-tainted beverages, well, the children, almost all of them cleared up, or the majority of them cleared up. And so that got David to thinking about, what part does aluminum play in attention deficit disorders, this spectrum of autistic disorders? And so he went to the literature. He found there were about 70, maybe 80 cases, and there were many similarities between them that sounded very characteristic of many of the things we see in autistic children. So you pick up the story there, David.
Well, from there, it appeared that certainly aluminum had some features that were similar to some of the problems seen in children with autism, you know, and even children who aren't on the spectrum that have, you know, we're seeing a variety of neurological disorders and developmental disorders in children today. So the obvious thing to do is to go to the federal agencies and say, gosh, do you have a limit on how much aluminum you can put in vaccine, number one? Number two, which vaccines have aluminum? Number three, how much, cumulatively, how much aluminum are kids exposed to? And it's really relatively simple to find the answer to these questions. The vaccines that kids get in the first year, the first year is the time where kids are really bombarded with multiple vaccines. They get them at birth, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 12 months, and then in the 15 to 18 month range. What I was seeing in the hepatitis B vaccine, the DTaP vaccine, which is diphtheria tetanus pertussis vaccine, that has aluminum. The Haemophilus B influenza vaccine, or HIB for short. Prevnar, which is the pneumococcal vaccine, has aluminum. Hepatitis A vaccine, which was added to the schedule a few years ago, that has aluminum. And so those are really the ones. The flu vaccine doesn't, the influenza viral vaccine. When you start adding that up, just in milligrams, you're seeing that these children are getting between 75 and 250, micrograms per day when they get shots. That's micrograms per kilogram. So the FDA says for aluminum exposure in children in vaccines, children can get about 850 mics per shot. Now, that's really a strange limit because they don't put it in weight adjustment. Mercury, of course, the EPA says you can get 0.1 mics per kilo per day. So when you talk about toxicity exposures, it's not the total amount of toxin. It's the total amount per body weight. We all know that an adult who drinks a can of beer may be fine, but you give a can of beer to an infant or a newborn, it could kill them. So we want to know how much toxin per body weight. So children today, average weight children, not preemies now, which is even worse, we're exposing children to between 75 and 250 micrograms per kilogram of body weight. The FDA doesn't really tell you what the limits are. You have to look around in the limitations based on parenteral feeding or IV solutions. There's aluminum, turns out, in feeding they give to preterm babies or babies that can't take by mouth because of illnesses. Or there's aluminum in solutions, medications that are given in sick kids that are born in the newborn period. The FDA says that anything, particularly for preemies, in the 4 to 5 mics per kilo per day is potentially dangerous. So that's rather odd. So on one hand, based on solutions, you can get 5 mics per kilo and up is dangerous, but in vaccines we're giving 250 mics per kilo. So there's really quite a discrepancy. In a publication in the journal Vaccine in 2002, by people from the FDA made this comment with regards to their 850 microgram per kilogram or per shot limit. They said, you know what, that limit is not based on safety. That limit is based upon what makes the vaccine adjuvant work as an adjuvant. And they found that 850 mics is about the limits of what you need to do the job. So there really isn't any safety limitations on how much aluminum you can put in vaccines. An organization who had been fighting the FDA for many, many years, a couple of organizations that are involved with nutrition in infancy, both parenteral and oral nutrition, had studied the cases of aluminum poisoning from those solutions, from feedings, intravenous feedings and solutions. And they determined that anything above 60 micrograms per kilogram is predictably toxic. And I'll say that again. 60 micrograms per kilogram body weight of aluminum is toxic. Not maybe toxic. Not could be toxic. They found it was uniformly toxic.
And, of course, you were just saying, of course, that these kids are getting, what, about 250 milligrams, getting, micrograms per kilogram?
They're getting 250, but I just reviewed a case a few weeks ago of a two-month preemie baby who was given his two-month shots when he was really the biological age of 0 months, and he got 900 micrograms per kilogram. So little babies, which the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics do not recommend Tulane vaccine schedule for small babies, they're getting multiple-fold above that.
But they're giving these vaccines, they're giving the hepatitis B, and there's no reason to give the hepatitis B. There's no medical reason at all, unless the mother has hepatitis B, to give that shot that they're giving to everyone in the nursery. You mean they're giving them to preemies as well?
Absolutely, they're giving it to preemies. And I'll tell you what else is pretty ironic. And I did an extensive review, and there's over 12,000 papers, something like that, on aluminum. I mean, it's an enormous body of literature. Aluminum causes jaundice. And guess what? What we see in newborns who are born, jaundice in the newborn period. How many of those cases are from the aluminum in the hepatitis B vaccine?
And what is it? Does it poison the liver or what?
It's hepatotoxic,
right.
You bet. It causes cholestasis. The bile stops flowing. It's toxic to bile production and the mitochondria which is the energy source of cells, particularly in the liver. So one of the most common maladies in infancy, particularly sick infants and preemies, and they're not born jaundiced, Dr. Stan, they're not born jaundiced. They develop jaundice usually, if you remember, in your pediatric rotations, you might remember seeing some jaundiced kids. They're put under the lamps for treatment of their hyperbilirubinemia. And I can't tell you that this is a proven fact, but it's certainly biologically plausible that one among the many things we'll talk about could be related to aluminum exposures. That includes not just vaccines, but includes things like total parenteral nutrition, IV solutions, simple IV drugs that are given, oral antacids that mom got, antacids that the children get put on, things like that. There are a lot of sources of aluminum. But really, the big hit is at the 2 months of age with the combination vaccines. These kids are getting, again, up to 250 mics per kilogram. So it appears, number one, the vaccine regulatory bodies do not have any limit to the amount of based on safety. What they limit in vaccines is based on how the aluminum boosts the immune response. It's not based on safety. One of the real unknowns, and there's really limited research in how quickly aluminum leaves an injection site. So there is a difference between getting aluminum in an intravenous solution where it goes directly into your vein and getting a vaccine which is into most of the time muscle and it's released from the muscle into the system. So I only found a handful of studies that took a look at how quickly it's released into the system. And it appears that most of the aluminum is released within 15 minutes of the injection. It doesn't bind to the antigen for very long. Once it gets to the normal body solution and body pH, it disassociates, and blood levels will rise rapidly, and they will peak in the first day or two.
Well, now, of course, does aluminum have a predisposition to go into the brain, certainly as fluoride does, and mercury?
Aluminum has no boundaries. No borders, nothing inhibits, and I found that aluminum is actually much more of a slippery character than mercury. It readily passes a normal blood-brain barrier. It goes into a cell, and it can enter any organelle in that cell. It can get into the DNA quite readily. It can alter DNA, so it passes the placental barrier into the mom. It's concentrated into the baby. It's concentrated to a higher degree in the baby than the mom. So there's really no tissue that aluminum can't get in and out of.
And, of course, isn't aluminum basically toxic then to the organelles and the mitochondria and things of that sort?
Well, it's toxic to about everything. One of the prime targets is mitochondria, and it does induce oxidative stress. Now, that's kind of a peculiar comment because we have just, and you may have had this discussed on your show previously, that the federal government, the vaccine court, just settled a case. They didn't settle a case. They basically admitted that there was a trial named Hannah Poling, who developed autism due to mitochondrial dysfunction or in association with mitochondrial dysfunction. The Health and Human Service experts agreed that the autism was related to the mercury-containing vaccine. I will say this, every vaccine with mercury except for the flu shot has aluminum in it too. So if a parent says, wow, I got a mercury-containing vaccine, gave it to our child and they regressed, they also got aluminum. It just hasn't been obviously emphasized. So aluminum is very toxic to the mitochondria. And I don't know if you've had Dr. Richard Dietz from Northeastern on your show before. He's one of the basic researchers in how mercury affects biochemical pathways. And I sent him some of the data I had found in the aluminum literature, and we calculated how much aluminum levels, the tissue levels from a vaccine, and we concluded based on published papers that the amount of aluminum in vaccines that would be toxic to mitochondria, there's a 30,000-fold higher blood level than necessary to be toxic to mitochondria.
30,000 times?
More toxic.
Right.
You know, so it's 30,000 higher than what's necessary to be toxic to mitochondria. And that's why one of the common symptoms of aluminum poisoning, even in the dialysis days from oral phosphate binders, was what? Muscle weakness.
Oh, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. David Ayoub. And ladies and gentlemen, this is such an important issue. We'll be right back. Well, David, go right ahead.
Well, so no question, the hot topic in autism these days is mitochondrial dysfunction. Aluminum, certainly, numerous studies show that it's a mitochondrial poison. Mercury is too, no question about that. So what we and the prevalence data that's coming out really depends a little bit how you define mitochondrial disease. It's very, there's not a real consistent, or at least not a unified definition of mitochondrial dysfunction, but you know, upwards to 40 to 50% of autistic children have mitochondrial dysfunction, which is obviously well above the background rate in neurotypical children. So mitochondrial impairment and autism are not rare co-partners, by any means. They're very common comorbidities.
And of course, the thing is, you know, is there a cumulative effect? In fact, we did a program with a naturopath yesterday, and he was talking about, well, of course, you know, you can have fluoride is a toxic, and in mice at a certain a minimal dose, why you kill one out of 100, and then the same thing would be true with lead. And so, you know, but if you gave the mouse both lead and mercury, and instead of killing two mice, which of course you would kill all of the mice, so there seems to be a cumulative effect with some of these heavy metals or some of the metals. Did you run into that idea that the combination of metals might also be cumulative?
Well, yeah, that's very important. And one of the there's a very strong evidence that mercury and aluminum both impair something called glutathione production.
Right.
Glutathione is a product in the body from a biochemical pathway, which is important in fighting basically cellular stress or oxidative stress. Mercury is eliminated in the body when glutathione binds to it and excretes it in the bile. Now, aluminum impairs glutathione production quite vigorously at the levels that can be achieved from vaccine. There's no question that it's not, it wouldn't require a super large dose compared to what we're giving kids. The doses that we're giving kids can certainly impair glutathione production. So what happens to a child who has impaired glutathione from his Hep B shot and his two-month shot? Now, today, the first mercury exposure to kids, the big one, is going to be 6 months, right, from the flu shot. So at 0, 2, and 4 months, the kid has gotten quite a bit of aluminum in vaccines, which knocks down the glutathione. Then you give a 25 microgram, or 12.5 microgram at 6 months, 12.5 microgram containing mercury-containing flu shot, glutathione is already way suppressed. And that's like giving perhaps 200 micrograms or 500 micrograms of mercury. The child at 6 months is in a state of impaired ability to eliminate the mercury. And this could be why we haven't seen a plunge in the autism rates. We have, since we took mercury out of the vaccines in, you know, the 2001-03 period, we've increased the amount of aluminum. That is effectively like increasing the amount of mercury. You see what I mean?
Right. Well, of course, the tragedy is, you know, you would think that they would have done all the scientific studies before they started doing this routinely on our children. They're really using our children as an experiment. There's certainly no justification for the hepatitis B vaccine at birth, in my estimation. So why are they doing that? And then have they done controlled studies to be absolutely sure they're safe? Are they simply going ahead and giving them, and then, well, if we find a problem, we'll stop it? Because how many lives of how many children can be destroyed by the overload of mercury and the overload of aluminum? And we'll be right back with Dr. Ayoub. Well, Dr. Stan, and of course David was simply talking about certainly the mercury and the aluminum can both actually suppress glutathione production in the body, and glutathione is necessary for the excretion of mercury. And so if you've given the child, you know, a great deal in the way of aluminum during the period between birth, where they give it shots in the nursery, and then at 2 months, and then by the time they get to be 6 months, and then while they're going to get their influenza shot with a full dose of mercury on that, why what you're doing is really increasing the toxicity of the mercury, because the child doesn't have any ability to bind the mercury with the glutathione, because everything's been wiped out by the aluminum they've had up to that point. So pick the story up there, David.
Well, if I was working at the FDA and I wanted to, you know, go backwards in time and say, okay, this is the animal study I want to see before we expose humans. The animal study I would want to see for vaccine safety is I would want to inject the adjuvant, aluminum hydroxide or aluminum. There's three different aluminum-containing adjuvants, either one. But inject one of these adjuvants alone, not mixed with the other compounds. Inject that in the animal at equivalent doses and see what happens to that animal. That's really the basic, you know, requirement for safety testing. That study wasn't done until 2007.
2007? Have you been giving vaccines all these years?
2007.
What did they find with the study?
Well, this was a study at the University of British Columbia, and the first author is Michael Petrick. I think the lead author from the lab is Christopher Shaw. And this got a little bit of press, the results of this, and it was published in the Neuromolecular Medicine Journal, which is not a real prominent journal, but it was a pretty good study, and here's what they did. They were studying the anthrax vaccine, and they wanted to assess the potential, and you may have heard of this study because I know you have a lot of speakers that talk about Gulf War Syndrome. The researchers wanted to look at some of the adjuvants, particular squalene, in the anthrax vaccine. So they took mice that were not newborn mice. They were equivalent of a young adult male human, so in age. So they weren't aged, they weren't newborns, they were vigorous. And they took, in one of their sample groups, they gave vaccines, they gave the squalene, but one group, they did give the aluminum hydroxide alone. And it gave it in doses that were equivalent to about one-fifth of the peak exposure in our kids. So they didn't give them a lot. I mean, it was smaller than our kids get. They got six different shots, but cumulatively it was one-fifth of the two-month shots that kids get, so about 50 to 60 mics per kilo equivalent. And they looked at these animals while they were alive, and they looked at behavior, and they found some statistically significant problems with the animals, that they had reduction in strength testing. They couldn't hang on to a wire mesh. They kept falling. They had anxiety testing abnormalities. They had some memory errors in maze testing. You know, it was not didn't knock them off their chairs. They noted it. Then they did the autopsies. And what they found at autopsy shocked them. And, in fact, it frightened them. It scared them. As they were quoted in one of the journalistic pieces that covered this, that it freaked them out. There was death of motor cells in the spinal cord. One out of three motor neurons in the spinal cord died. And cells were dying in the cerebral motor cortex. And when they stained the brain for aluminum, they found that aluminum was inside the cells that were dying, in the nuclei of the cells that were dying.
And, of course, this was a much lower level than they're giving our children.
It's much lower. And I'll say this, that toxicologists, at least with as far as mercury goes, say that mice in general are not a great model for testing human sensitivities, that they tend to be relatively insensitive to metal toxicity when compared to humans. So a primate study would be a much better model. And when you think about this, as studies, there's at least a dozen studies in autism that show motor impairment. And probably the best study done last year showed 100% of autistic children, if you carefully measure motor function, have abnormal motor skills. Number of ways to measure it. This is a motor toxin. This would result in a motor dysfunction. And when I look at the Gardasil vaccines, Guillain-Barré, paralysis, I look at videotapes from newscasts from these young girls that have got Gardasil, which contains aluminum, and you see spasticity, discoordinated movement, weakness, fatigue, you know, very classic kind of symptoms of aluminum poisoning, and you have to wonder if are the Gardasil reactions we're seeing nothing more than aluminum poisoning.
And, of course, what we're seeing, of course, is an active marketing campaign on the part of Merck Group. Get parents. If you love your child, why, you want to give them the Gardasil, you know, so they're not going to get cervical cancer if they're promiscuous and, out to violating all God's rules. And, you know, it is really frightening to me talking to some of these people who worked on the Gardasil saying, well, you know, vaccines are safe and effective, you know, and there may be some problems with this vaccine, but vaccines are safe and effective. And these people have never stopped and thought what we're doing. We're experimenting on a whole generation of our young girls, and now they want to give the young boys as well. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Dr. David Hayob, and we're talking about aluminum toxicity and, of course, the fact that it does interfere with motor cells, and actually it destroys the motor cells. And in the mice, why, literally one out of every three of the cells was at the cerebral cortex or in the spine that was destroyed. David?
That was one out of three cells in the spinal cord. Motor cells in the spinal cord.
Okay, fine. Of course, when we were mentioning the Gardasil vaccine, for those of you who don't know, Gardasil is this vaccine they want to give to very young girls, you know, in the ninth grade, something like that, you know, so that they won't get human papillomavirus, HPV infection, and then get cervical cancer in later life. So they want to give it to every little girl so that she can go out and be promiscuous, and well, she won't get the hepatitis, she won't get the human papillomavirus. But what are we doing to a whole a generation of our girls by giving them the potentially toxic vaccine? And now they want to, of course, make it standard for boys as well. After all, I mean, if the boys don't have it, they're not going to be able to give it to the girls. So what we're doing is saying, well, go ahead and be promiscuous. There's nothing to worry about. We've given you a shot. We've given you a shot. You're protected. And you're not protected. I mean, there's only one thing that will protect our children from sexually transmitted disease. That is abstinence before marriage and fidelity afterwards, but that's not the message of the medical profession in America today. Go ahead, David. I'll get off my soapbox.
No, I was listening to you. I agree with you completely. I, you know, you've heard an awful lot in the press about the Gardasil reactions, and frankly, you know, with any of these cases of vaccine reactions, there are ways to test for aluminum toxicity. It has been defined by the dialysis, you know, physicians, and nephrologists who had to deal with this in the 80s when adults or children got very, very sick on dialysis, and they realized most of the cases it wasn't contamination of the water. It was actually the oral phosphate binders they gave them to control their serum phosphate that contained a lot of aluminum, and combined with the inability to make urine, they couldn't clear the aluminum, and they had toxicity. So they did something called they measured serum levels for one thing, and they saw the serum levels of aluminum were high, and they treated. And deferoxamine is one of these substances that's used to chelate iron in thalassemia disorders, also chelates aluminum. And in cases of severe poisoning, where the individuals that had aluminum poisoning were comatose in the extreme state, they were able to reverse this completely. The DFO did cross into the brain. It did bind aluminum and eliminated it.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, we're talking about the aluminum toxicity and, of course, how much was learned about that by the doctors who are doing dialysis. Of course, they were inadvertently poisoning the people during the 1980s who were taking renal dialysis by giving them aluminum compounds to try to, negate other problems. And of course, what they were doing in the process was poisoning their patients inadvertently, not realizing what they were doing, but try to avoid some of the other complications of dialysis. So pick up the story there, David.
Well, you know, we did know, and I think the reason we're going forward on this in autism is because there is a potential specific treatment for it. So I think the next step after we reviewed the literature and decided, yeah, aluminum and vaccines could be certainly contributing to autism, if not, you know, frankly causing autism, we decided to look at a subset of children, basically a random set of kids from a practice in Chicago, a very large practice, from a physician who was seeing, I think, about 1,500 kids in the practice. And we just started randomly going through charts until we accumulated a reasonable number of either hair analysis of EDTA challenge, that's ethyl disodium EDTA, which is a lead chelator but also pulls aluminum. And a lot of these kids have lead poisoning, so they do this, and they give an injection, they test the urine, and they see whether lead comes out, but you can look at aluminum too. So we looked for those profiles, and we looked for urinary porphyrin tests. Porphyrin is another specific test that helps identify systemic aluminum poisoning.
Won't that also help you with mercury poisoning as well?
Absolutely, and that's what it's used for mostly, but there's a number of papers that show that first step in the pathway is impaired by aluminum. So inadvertently, and this is also something I picked up from the autism, you know, the moms of autistic children, They sent me copies of their testing, and it was a uriporphyrin that was high. And this wasn't a marker for mercury. It was a marker for aluminum. So that was supportive. So anyway, we just piled through charts, and I presented this at the Dan think tank last fall. And we had upwards of about 40 kids. And we found that 76% of the kids we looked at had toxic levels of aluminum in their hair. 66% had abnormal porphyrin testing that was consistent with aluminum poisoning. And 97% of the kids had aluminum from their EDTA provocation. In other words, when they got a dose of EDTA, it pulled aluminum out of their bodies. So we saw a pretty high prevalence of aluminum in these kids' bodies. But we found a problem with at least one of these measures, and that's EDTA, which is used very frequently to chelate these kids for mostly lead toxicity, contains aluminum as a contaminant. So if a child got EDTA, it may be introducing the aluminum that we're measuring. So we really couldn't publish the data. We found out after we looked at this analysis that this was a confounder in the study, and we are currently contemplating using DFO, which is deferoxamine that doesn't contain an aluminum contaminant, and take a look at this closer. So there is, I think, some promise that we can diagnose tissue-level aluminum retention. Because remember, these kids got these exposures at the age of 1 to 2. They're 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. So this aluminum isn't going to be floating around in their blood. It's going to be locked into tissue, and you have to measure the tissue. You have to somehow get this aluminum out to measure it. And bone biopsies is an invasive way to do it, but it's possible. It's technically feasible. They did this in people on dialysis. But the DFO challenges, we're contemplating a study to take to really more accurately assess this, and there are published standards for the DFO responses. So we may be able to identify by medical definition, by widely accepted criteria, aluminum poisoning in childhood today in children who are autistic. It's a theory. It's obviously a hypothesis we're testing. And we hope to be able to, come up and take a look at this data and see what we get.
Well, then, of course, would this be treatable? Would you be able to actually help the children by the ED, whatever you're going to be using to get the aluminum out? And would it help to get up against the lead and the mercury as well? Because certainly there may very well be a cumulative effect from all of these things.
Absolutely. And, we are seeing kids benefit from biomedical intervention in general. And so the treatments that they're giving children, I'm not sure you've had any speaker on your show that talked about the biomedical approach to autism. I'm not a treating doctor, but I've been at a number of the meetings, and I understand some of the success they're having, and I've seen a lot of published data on this. There are some profound improvements, and there are cases, and I have now friends with children who are no longer autistic. I've seen this with my own eyes. I've seen complete reversal of autism.
We've actually talked to the Geyers a fair amount of detail on their work as far as the autistic children and the mercury. But, of course, this is simply much, much broader than what we're really talking about is trying to get all of these toxic metals out.
That's right. And in fact, these biomedical interventions, they're treating at the cellular level. So those things that improve oxidative stress and improve methylation function, increasing glutathione, in effect is counteracting aluminum poisoning as well. So we don't know specifically. I think the real potential benefit is the children that are very, very sick and have severe motor dysfunction, severe regression, and have no speech. In the cases of aluminum poisoning in childhood we reviewed, one of the consistent findings was loss of speech, speech regression, loss of speech. And the moms, this is a non-published data, but consistently, the moms I spoke with and the profiles I looked at, the higher the aluminum, the worse these children's speech were. And many of them actually had responded very well to biomedical, never have regained their speech. So it is possible that aluminum speech link is very strong, and DFO might unlock the door to speech in some of these kids.
Have you actually tried the DFO with them, or is this something you're contemplating?
I'm not a treating doctor.
Right.
as you know, the doctors that are treating are under a magnifying glass, and they're right. Under enormous scrutiny and pressure, and they do not want a complication in their practice. There was a couple cases of deaths from a EDTA that was the wrong form, and it was a calcium EDTA, not the calcium disodium form, and that was widely publicized. as a potentially dangerous treatment for autism. So I think that they're very leery of using an agent that does have some side effects. It has bone marrow suppression side effects usually in prolonged doses. There's even cases of visual problems on DFO. So, a number of physicians that I've presented the data to and I'm working with are considering this and contemplating it. And probably there are some cases out there that have used this. I'm just not aware of it. But so we still have a little ways to go to try to prove this hypothesis that this is a contributor.
Now, what about the age? Is the younger you get them, the better we have it? Because there's actually a woman in our area. She's got two autistic children, or at least one severe ADH, and the other is frankly autistic. But one of them is 14 years of age. It's just a terrible burden for her. You get a child that age, do you think that getting rid of the toxic metals might have any benefit for him?
Well, from talking to the doctors, this is the sense that I get. And I know some kids that started treatment at that age, so I can give you some anecdotal information as well. In general, the biomedical doctors will tell you this, that the more severe the autism, in other words, when it's towards this towards mental retardation of the spectrum, a severe motor dysfunction, severe cognitive impairment, and the older the child is, the worse the prognosis.
Right.
In general. The earlier and the milder, the better. Number two, I know of cases that have been completely reversed, and a very good friend of mine who runs one of the state chapters for the National Autism Association got involved politically. Her teenage son had pretty severe autism, and they were actually looking for an institution to put him in at the age of, I think, 13 or 14. 2 years later, they were looking for colleges. A tremendous success story. Now, those are difficult cases. I don't want to give your listeners the idea that this is, you push a button and this happens. These are the exceptional outcomes. But no, it is possible, and I've been to lectures. Dr. Jeff Bradstreet, who's in Florida, gave a lecture at one of the DAN conferences a year or two ago on outcomes in adults with autism or neurodevelopmental disorders. And a substantial number of those adults improve. It may not be, improve. He's talking about mostly institutionalized patients, but in a variety of ways. Medical conditions improve. Seizures stop. Speech, in some cases, I think he showed cases of somebody gained speech that they didn't have as an adult. So, yeah, there is some definite benefit in older children as well.
Well, it's such an important issue. Many people, of course, with treating autistic children, recognizing the aluminum relationship as well as the mercury and other toxic metals.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm just wondering if the doctors you talked to were aware of the aluminum connection. In other words, so many people focus on the mercury. In fact, until you mentioned it, I guess a year or two ago, I'd never really even thought of the possibility of a relationship between autism and aluminum. But are other people looking into this and aware of your work?
Well, I presented this at the National Autism Association last fall as a hypothesis work, and also the small clinical pilot survey study that we did, and it was mostly to parents. But I gave again the data at the think tank, the DAN think tank, only to the biomedical physicians. And they were impressed at the volume of data that was there. I think until we come up with a clear way to treat this, they feel that they're already treating a lot of the underlying abnormalities. Treating some of the cellular level that they're treating this, so they don't, they're not convinced that there's a altered path of treatment at this point. And I think until we show, the benefits, and I think the most optimal thing I could think of, at least in medicine, is deferoxamine, which is a track record for, removing aluminum and reversing aluminum poisoning. Until we do that, I'm not sure anyone else is doing other things. Now, I've heard of some alternative therapy doctors, nutritionists and herbalists and so forth. And in fact, the nutritionist in Southern Illinois has had a lot of success using infrared sauna and I think a herbal formula, cilantro, Chinese parsley or cilantro apparently binds and eliminates aluminum. And he was able, and he showed me some profiles of, these substances pulling aluminum out of the body. So he was targeting it in other ways. But the majority of the traditional DAN biomedical doctors, I don't think, are really doing anything specific for aluminum. But as I said, anything that boosts glutathione and improves oxidative stress and mitochondrial function is going to counter some of the aluminum effects.
Now, you mentioned infrared sauna. Are they actually getting them to actually perspire, to sweat the toxins out of the body? Is that how it works?
Well, you know, and the nutritionists tend to treat older children and adults with this. It's pretty hard to put a young infant in a sauna and sweat it out. So I don't think they're doing this in 2-, 3-, or 4-year-old kids. But, you know, the nutrition doctors have a smaller, you know, arsenal of therapy.
Right.
So they're doing whatever they can do. And I will say this, that melatonin, there are a number of papers that show aluminum poisoning impairs melatonin synthesis, number one. Number two, melatonin is a very powerful antioxidant. And I didn't know this, but it's actually more powerful than vitamin C or vitamin E as an antioxidant. And if you look at the Autism Research Institute, they compile, I don't know how many thousands of surveys from parents now. I think it's 10,000-20,000, you know, surveys of parents. Melatonin is very high up on the list for these, you know, for single beneficial therapies. So melatonin is one way to combat aluminum toxicity.
You know, one of the things that really bothers me is, why is the medical board so, you know, intent upon, you know, going after the doctors who are treating and many times helping these children with autism, and yet, of course, you know, it's almost as if they're doing something wrong in trying to cure these children.
Well, that's a deep political question.
All right. Yeah, maybe you don't want to get into that subject, but of course I have my thoughts on this, because I think but the doctors should be allowed to do what they're doing, and certainly as long as the parents understand that that this is experimental, at least they ought to be able to do the studies, and if it will help, you know, the opportunity. But certainly the people need to have informed consent. So much of what's being done today is done without informed consent, and the mass of experiments that's being done on our population by the use of hepatitis B vaccine, you know, in infancy, the mass experiments that's being done with Gardasil on our young girls. I mean, all of these things, they do not have the studies that they need to say that they're safe. There's no long-term studies on the effectiveness of Gardasil in stopping cervical cancer because it hasn't been around that long.
No, that's right. There are plenty of studies, and they are cited as studies which support efficacy and support safety. But as you know, what people claim studies say and what the studies actually say can be two different things.
Because the tragedy is there's so much money to be made in this, and sometimes a science is prostituted in the name of money, and many times these studies are done, and if they don't come up with a conclusion that the drug companies want, they're actively suppressed. They get these things on the market, they make billions of dollars, and then there's that, oops, oh, well, maybe we better take it off, look at the harm we're doing, the cancers we're producing. I'm thinking of Vytorin, one of the, I believe it's one of the statin drugs, really doesn't do much good, but it does it. You have a tendency to produce cancer, and that long-term studies given to millions of people find, oh, shucks, we just made another mistake.
Yeah.
And, of course, the thing is that when, you know, science, it gives way to, you know, to a profit, and when so many of the scientists who are working here are invested in the very companies that they're supposedly, you know, checking to find out if the products are valid, we get skewed results, and nobody's ever held responsible. Science has to be in pursuit of truth. And, of course, when scientists are investing in stock companies, you really have to stop and wonder and ask yourself, will their scientific studies be valid?
That's right. Well, you know, when I analyzed the pre-licensure studies for Gardasil, I found, I think it was something like 8 out of 9 studies had patent holders as co-authors. So, and that's pretty ridiculous. And we also know that ghostwriting is rampant in the industry. And up to 50% of the papers are actually written by marketing departments and science departments, or you know, companies that are hired by the drug companies to write the literature and kind of tweak the statistics, so to speak. So there's an awful lot of literature, but there's a paucity of good science.
Well, I really appreciate what you're doing, and certainly your efforts to bring this matter out. Is anybody else working with you on this? Is anybody else doing parallel research at the time?
Well, I don't know. Of any, you know, I don't know for sure. I know that there's been interest in starting a primate study that may go forward this fall, and we will do a complete toxicokinetic analysis of aluminum. Just simple things that should have been done, you know, decades ago. measure serum aluminum after a vaccine. We have known cutoffs. We know what's defined as aluminum poisoning. So we may be in a primate study be able to show that routine vaccines cause aluminum poisoning. Now, wouldn't that be something? But we're planning to meet in September and discuss the design of the study.
Apparently, you know, they've done primate studies with mercury and found out that certainly aren't there some studies that show that mercury is related to almost an autistic syndrome in primates?
The primate study by Tom Burbacher in Seattle was only a histopathology or a toxicology study. They didn't measure quantitative behaviors, but Phase two of that study is being done now. I don't know if that's been published. And the other primate study with Andy Wakefield was involved and presented three abstracts at a European meeting. That hasn't been published in peer review yet.
All right, hold on.
That did show behavior abnormalities, yes.
We'll be back in just a moment. Well, I guess this evening, David A. David, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out for our listeners?
Well, I have a kind of a private website, and I send people who email me, I refer them to this website, and I have about a 400 or 500 page PDF file of my aluminum lecture notes that people can download. A little bit technical, but it's got a lot of the data and references in that.
Well, of course, you did a great job on that file that you gave us as far as your mercury research was concerned. In fact, we sent out quite a few of these across the country, and it's amazing how many people will actually see your talk up there on our website and then call and want to get the DVD of that, so we're distributing it. I don't know if you'd be want some of them. You know, you can make them yourselves, or if you ever wanted, you could get them from us, because I think it's an excellent, excellent tool. We really appreciated you coming out and giving us a talk on mercury.
It was a pleasure for me and an honor.
Well, I hope maybe one of these days we can get you out on the aluminum, because I can, you're obviously on the front lines of this battle. And what we need, of course, people to understand the dangers of heavy and even light metal poisoning. Certainly, I mean, even though aluminum, I don't think it's considered a heavy metal. It is toxic, as is the fluoride, and all of these things are toxic to the brain. And really what bothers me is the damage we're doing to our children, and I'm sure you're concerned as well.
Well, we've known this for over 100 years. There were reports of learning disorders in children exposed to aluminum in the 1920s. So
right.
This isn't, nothing's new. There's nothing new under the sun.
I think that comes from the Bible. But anyway, there's an awful lot of wisdom. It was actually Solomon who said that. Well, David, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. And do hope that we can get you out here to one of our conferences maybe next year or so. Because I really would like to have a DVD. Do you have this on a talk anyplace?
I think... The aluminum lecture I gave, the National Autism Association, you may be able to purchase that. I'm not real sure, but you might check with the National Autism Association from the fall 2007 conference.
All right, fine. Well, if not, we'll have to get you out here, because I thought the job that our photographer did was excellent, and it certainly got wide coverage across America under any circumstances. God bless you. We'll talk to you later.
God bless you. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And, of course, our guest this evening, Dr. David Ayub, and we're very, very fortunate to have him. Here's a gentleman who just got started doing the research. He became aware there's a problem. He's a radiologist, but because he had the scientific ability to be able to evaluate what was going on, he has done some of the finest work we have on the subject of mercury and now on aluminum and, well, what... Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to our programs, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us bring you the information you're not going to get through regular channels. And we're indeed fortunate to get experts in the field like Dr. Ayub and many of the other people we have appearing here on Radio Liberty, so at least our listeners will know what's going on. So much of this information is actively suppressed by the media. So much of this is actually suppressed by certain people within the medical field who have a different agenda. Maybe this interferes with their profit margin, or maybe they they do not have the human compassion that they should have working in the medical field. Well, under any circumstances, if you have not yet seen Dr. David Eob's talk on mercury, it is available on DVD, and with that, of course, is a free CD-ROM with literally thousands of pages of the research he's done that going into the background of what was known about mercury toxicity, the substance that they're putting into the vaccines that they give to your children and to the elderly today. Today, of course, they're giving it to the elderly for influenza, the children for influenza, starting at age 6 months of age, where it'll do the most damage. They're giving it to pregnant women. Why would you give something that was potentially dangerous and destructive to the child in utero? Why would you give it to a woman during the first trimester? You'll have to ask yourself that question. Is it possible there are people who have a different agenda, who look at the world differently than you and I do, who have no compassion for human suffering and the damage they're producing? Well, this is, I just want to mention, of course, this program is being heard certainly on the in our West Coast stations there in Seattle, pardon me, in Southern Washington. And I do want to mention that we're having an opportunity now to come on to a program. It'll be 5 to 6 in Spokane, and it'll be a daily program plus a weekly program. And Tom Reed very generously has offered this slot to us. We would like to raise the funds ahead of time so we know that we'll be able to keep up for 6 months or so until we can get the program to pay for itself. And so if you would be interested in helping or know anybody helping or who would like to be a sponsor to that program, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And we're hoping very soon there to be on in Spokane 5 to 6 on a daily basis, and where you can actually be able to hear our afternoon program for the previous day. So I think you'll hopefully we'll be out there and very, very soon. And then, of course, we do want to suggest, if you are not acquainted with our ministry and what we're really all about, that you get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and or the DVD that goes with that. Actually, in this case, the book came from the talk that we gave, which is available on DVD. It's the Brotherhood of Darkness, which will introduce you to a whole different world. And then, of course, you would want to get my talk on the forbidden secret. The forbidden secret, there really is a secret that's been passed down for 5,000 years. And, of course, it's been passed down through the various empires that have existed by the sages, by the priests, by the mystics, by those people who tapped into the other dimension, and were the advisors to the kings. It's been known to the great philosophers, many of the great leaders. And, well, we're going to tell you the secret. And, of course, you will never look at the world through the same eyes again. After you've heard my talk on the forbidden secret, there is a syllabus that goes with that. We also have another talk on that same subject. It's called The Secret Knowledge. And then, of course, we have my talk on the planned police state and who's really behind this. And you really need to get the syllabus. And, of course, everybody would like to know who really runs the world. If you get any of our items, just ask for the pamphlet. It's entitled The Workings of the Spiritual Hierarchy. It is put out by the organizations that really run the world. And they're quite blatant, you know. They figure that we're so stupid, we'll never understand what's going on. So they openly talk to their followers. That's The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. I remember our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Janet Palin. And Janet, of course, is an investigative reporter. She has her own radio program up in Oregon, in Ashland, Oregon. And then she appears on the Republican Broadcasting Network, John Statmiller's network. And but since 9-1-1, she's focused her work on eugenic programs within the United States. And she's best known for her article on the water as a weapon and her investigations into that aspect. And so we're going to, of course, go ahead and get started talking about some of the problems with eugenics, with elder abuse. And this is, I think, a subject very close to Janet's heart. Janet, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you very much, Stan. I'm very pleased to be on your show.
All right, fine. And, of course, what time of the day are you on the Republic Radio?
Republic Broadcasting right. Network. I am on Saturdays between noon and 2 o'clock Pacific time.
All right, fine. And so, well, let's go ahead. And certainly you had sent me some of the material about, I mean, unfortunate cases where elderly people had certainly been turned over to conservatorships. And sometimes when they're turned over to conservatorships, why, of course, especially if there's money involved, why there seems to be all sorts of machinations there. And certainly the elderly people unable to look after their own affairs, once they come under the control of these government controls, conservatorships, why, of course, many times they're treated with crass indifference. So you pick up the story from there. I mean,
right.
How did you get involved in this issue, and what's the solution to it?
Well, the solution to it, I got initially involved in reporting on the issue because of what happened to my own mother, Dr. Amalie Phelan, formerly of Temecula, California. I became aware that the courts had become corrupt and that they were basically rubber stamping the fate of the elderly people through these conservatorship programs. Just briefly, for the listening audience, a conservatorship or guardianship, the words are really interchangeable, is initiated when there are allegations of lack of capacity. That means that you're kind of screwing up, in other words. And these can be, these allegations generally are initiated against elderly or disabled people. Although we're seeing now where people who are perfectly competent are being put under conservatorship when there is a financial impetus to do so. And I want to speak briefly about a case that I'm aware of up in Portland, Oregon, where a 49-year-old woman who's a college graduate, mother of four, and was married to an extremely wealthy man, very hooked up. He was a builder. He owned companies all over the country. Her name is Susan DeMuro.
Well, but just to not get so much into the names.
Okay, well, then I won't name names. All right.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, they basically went into divorce proceedings. And her husband went to his, apparently his buddy, the judge, and without her knowledge or consent, had her put under a conservatorship and guardianship and in order to get a favorable divorce settlement for him. And having met Susan DeMuro and having looked at the psychiatric assessments that were made of Susan DeMuro, I can assure you that I would like to be as incompetent as Susan DeMuro.
Well, hold that thought for just a moment,
right.
Please. All right, you go right ahead here.
Okay. Anyway, this lady
well,
is...
Well, just call her Susan.
We'll call her Susan. Sorry, I know. I just... Susan is very bright, very verbal, actually really stunningly attractive, and very well put together, and her presentation is very good, and the psychiatrist who examined her for lack of capacity generally thought so as well. But the judge was absolutely determined to facilitate the needs of her husband.
Well, I think, of course, what we have a corrupt jury system, and we have a corrupt judicial system, because, of course, we've taken any sense of right and wrong and morality out of our society. There is no right, there is no wrong. It's he who has, of course, the most goodies wins.
Well, this is the prevailing ethic. It is, as I'm sure you're aware, Dr. Monteith, this is not an ethic that many people really do support. And one of the problems we're having with the conservatorship story is that the mainstream media is running away from the story. And usually when that happens, it means that there is something else going on here. There's a really darker impetus. And back to the situation of the elderly. The series of articles that I have authored on this subject is called The Probate Murders, and you can find a couple of them simply by Googling The Probate Murders. And the reason that I entitled it that rather than The Probate Theft is that, unfortunately, the greed motive has become so dominant that that it doesn't seem to matter to the courts in many, many venues if the elderly people are denied medicine by the conservators, if they're denied medical care, and therefore simply pass on.
But aren't there really too many elderly that are just, as they say, useless eaters? Don't you think that's the attitude of many of the people within this the environment today? Once you're no longer productive, you might as well be done away with. So it's very similar to what they had in Nazi Germany. But there is very little morality. Certainly we know, for instance, we have the hostels, you know, and you go into a hospice, you know, when you're going to die. But they're only paying for you for 6 months, so they're going to be sure that you die. And I know people have been in touch with the people that work in the hospices all across America, financed by our federal government, and they, of course, are just easing these people out. They might not die ordinarily, but they're sure going to die before their 6 months is up.
Well, there are some cases that I'm aware of where hospice has been used to basically end someone's life, and
hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Well,
this is Dr. Stan. We're talking with Janet Palin, certainly about the program of crass indifference to human life here. And we were talking about the hospice, where sometimes hospices are actually used to ease people who would not ordinarily die, but they're going to die within 6 months because that's all the government will pay for them. If they do a real good job and they keep them alive, well, then they're stuck with them. And so, believe me, I've talked to people within the medical profession who've been advised by people working in the hospice service, you know, why don't you just give them an overdose of insulin? No one will know, and you can just ease them out of their suffering. Well, that's not the job of anybody in the medical profession. It's ease suffering, but certainly not use that right we have to prescribe medicine to kill. Unfortunately, we are in a post-Christian society where there is no right, there's no wrong, and of course we have to work within the confines of the government money, the government funding, and after all, Medicare is costing us so much, care of the elderly is costing us so much. There's obviously a solution, since we can't expect the families to look after them, children to look after their parents. Let's just ease them out of their suffering. Go right ahead.
Before I talk about the situation of Corinne, and I'll try to leave the last names off if that's what you wish, although I have run this story before without blocking out the last name, but we'll just leave it with first names right now. Before I talk about what happened to Corinne, who was not terminally ill, had no terminally ill diagnosis before she was put into hospice, I want to say something about what you said a few moments ago about Hitler and the useless eaters. Hitler had a program. It was called the T4 program, and it was the first wholesale extermination program that he actually introduced into Germany. And in the T4 programs, they were targeting the elderly and disabled. And apparently, from what I've read about history, there was such an outcry from the German population. I mean, they were killing off their parents and their beloved, you know, and somewhat limited, maybe, you know, intellectually limited children and sisters and brothers, and there was such an outcry that Hitler officially stopped the T4 program, although I do understand that it was continued on in secret. And what I'm very concerned about is that what we are seeing in our country is really the same sort of mentality and the same sorts of programs being reinstituted, but with a different sort of patina on them. The spin machine in this country has really gotten a lot of people confused as to what our leadership is really about.
Well, I think that people really have to understand that Hitler's ideas and many of his eugenic ideas did not originate in Germany. They originated right here in the United States in the eugenic movement being pushed by Planned Parenthood, being financed by the Rockefeller Foundation, being popularized by Margaret Sanger. And actually, it was people working with Germany, people like Ernst Rudin of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, who came to America, got the ideas, took them back to Germany, and what Hitler did was simply applied science. We're going to produce a perfect gene pool. We're going to get useless eaters. And unfortunately, people don't understand the origin of these concepts. They did not originate in Germany.
You are so right about that. And once again, we go back to reality versus illusion. And the illusion of what America is has so saturated the consciousness of the American citizens that when you present them with the reality of what our country is doing to its own population, not even, you know, the horrors of the Iraqi war, but what's happening here under our own eyes, this is where I think a lot of people, you know, begin to balk and to deny and to refuse to admit that we have actually entered into the sort of arena that we have. Now, what I was going to say about Corinne, Corinne was in her 90s, and one of her daughters was apparently stealing from the estate, and the other daughter found out, and there was a police report, blah, blah, blah. The first daughter had Corinne's grandson go into court ex parte and make allegations that Corinne was incapacitated, this, that, the other thing. Slapped her with a conservatorship. The conservatorship only lasted, I believe it was 10 weeks, because that's all that Corinne lasted. And she was put into hospice. I have seen the medical records. Corinne had a diagnosis of colitis. Somehow this got translated into a bogus diagnosis of colon cancer. Bogus. And Corinne lasted, I believe it was about 10 days in hospice. She was hit with so much morphine that the morphine apparently killed Corinne. Now we're seeing over and over again where hospice, I'm hearing from people, the hospice scam, because when you have an elderly person who will have medical issues because they're simply elderly, if you take a person who has already compromised, let's say, respiratory system or, you know, some problems, cardiac problems, and you start hitting them with massive doses of morphine, it will put the person into respiratory arrest. And we have seen this in the documentation over and over again. Another case that I have looked at rather carefully, and this is also reported in Probate Murders, Part 2 was the case of, we'll say, Elizabeth. And Elizabeth was under conservatorship with a conservatorship firm in Southern California, which has gotten a lot of scrutiny and a lot of not quite enough bad press, we'll say. And Elizabeth came down with pneumonia. And just about the time that her money had run out, and conservatorships are very expensive, and when she came down with pneumonia, her conservator decided that she should not get antibiotics. So Elizabeth expired from pneumonia, which is treatable. And at the point of her having viewed the medical records, which were put into the court file and could be viewed by anyone, at the point of her increasing respiratory distress with pneumonia, the doctor administered, per the orders of the conservator, two doses of an opiate called Roxanol, which is basically, you know, related to morphine, and she succumbed after the second dose. So what we are seeing here is a situation where the greed motive, the profit motive, has become so rampant that human life simply doesn't matter to these corrupt and greedy conservators and their attorneys.
Well, it's unfortunate, but I suspect that this is quite widespread. I've had a certain amount of experiences personally, having been a conservator on my aunt, and repeatedly, I know when she was in a state institution, she'd run out of her money, was on Medi-Cal, and on several occasions when she really needed medical treatment, they would call me and say, well, now, you really want us to take her to the hospital to be seen with running this temperature? And I said, yes, of course I do. But they really were not anxious for me to do that. They just assumed that, she had not been treated, that she was getting on in age. But, you know, the attitude really has changed so much when I was practicing medicine and those young idealistic ages. Times why we were so concerned about the preservation of human life, I'll never forget. It was in the late 1950s. And it appears we're moving back in that direction again. We've lived in a utopian society where human life had a great deal of value. But now that we've turned our back on the moral foundation in America, why, of course, we're becoming increasingly callous and concerned about the degradation of human rights, whether it be the Iraqi or prisoners, or whether it be somebody we suspect might be a terrorist, or the elderly in our own country. It's all one ball of wax. You're either concerned about human life and human dignity, or you've lost your human compassion. And what bothers me so much, Janet, is the lack of concern by our Christian leaders who should be on the front lines of this battle. And, of course, their activity is deafening in its silence.
Well, the way that I look at it is that money and murder have married. And we see this now on many, many different fronts. We see it in the Iraqi war. We see it in the treatment of the elderly. We see it. In the blind eye that people are turning to the homeless and their needs. I won't go into in great depth the implications of Army Regulation 210-35 in terms of the eventual dispensation of the homeless population. I do want to mention very quickly that the Venice Beachhead did publish Homeless No More in the August issue, and I've been overwhelmed with the responses to that. But we are really living in a society now where human life doesn't matter, but money does.
You're absolutely right. And what a terrible thing it is when a society has lost its idealism, and, of course, our politicians are leading the way. In fact, we find now, of course, the senator from Alaska has been indicted for over simply corruption. But most of them are corrupt. He is probably no more corrupt than most of them. What a tragedy it is. Even sometimes the millionaires are the most greedy. As someone once said, the least needy are usually the most greedy. Well, Janet, you go right ahead.
Well, you were making statements a few minutes ago concerning mental defectives. And I want to expand a little bit on that for the listening audience. Mental illness in this country is the only illness, or the allegations of mental illness, is the only quote-unquote illness that a person can be treated for against their will or consent. And we saw in Soviet Russia, we saw enormous abuses going on where dissidents and political activists were being stuck into mental hospitals, and very often didn't fare very well there. And I think the term, the current term is, chemical lobotomy. And unfortunately, what we are seeing here now, because of this almost loophole where if a person is adjudicated mentally ill or incompetent, they can and often will be funneled off to a mental hospital for treatment against their will. And what we're seeing now in this country is once again where dissidents and activists are facing this sort of treatment. And Susan Lindauer, who was a reporter and a congressional aide and had been working for the U.S. government prior to the Iraqi war, was treated very badly by her own country when she had volunteered her testimony to the Bush's Commission on Pre-Iraqi War Intelligence. She had been working in a capacity where she would have had some inside knowledge about this bogus weapons of mass destruction story that was being touted on the front page of the New York Times and elsewhere. And within 72 hours after she contacted the commission to offer her testimony, she was first arrested as an operative, some sort of operative for the Iraqi government. She had been working for our government, not for Iraq. And then she was judged incompetent to stand trial and sent off to Carswell Federal Prison Mental Hospital, very likely to rot. After being there about 7 months, and she was only supposed to be there for 4 months of observation, which, as you probably know, Dr. Montes, is a very, very long period of assessment. They kept her for 7 months, and then the government went to court to have her forcibly medicated. So due to the intervention of a number of outraged journalists and other parties, Susan Lindauer is now free. But this is a method by which a person can be entirely stripped of their rights. And we are seeing it happen, not only, in cases like Susan Lindauer's, who was obviously very bright and very eloquent woman, but what is happening to the elderly and the disabled, who very likely may have issues with lack of capacity. What we are seeing happen to these people is absolutely horrific.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, Janet Palin, simply talking about her concern about what's happening to the elderly in many instances when they're incapable of looking after their own affairs. And, of course, if there's a great deal of money involved, the family would certainly want to have them. Well, of course, if they died early, why, of course, they could get their hands on the money. Unfortunately, this sort of thing does happen in society when people have forgotten the purpose of children is to honor their mother and their father. But, of course, we could never put that on the walls of our schoolrooms today because it wouldn't do any good unless the children read it. And if they read it, they might obey it. And that would be a violation of the wall of separation between church and state, and that was the dictum of our United States Supreme Court. There is to be no moral foundation for society, and then you wonder why a generation later we have a society without a moral foundation. Go right ahead, Janet.
Right, and you keep, it's so important that you keep stressing the moral vacancy here. I did have the pleasure of listening to Barry Chalmish on your show last week sometime. where he was talking about this work by this rabbi, Antelman, called Eliminating the Opiate.
Well, that was a Barry Shamish, yes.
Yeah, Barry Thomas, right. And the Eliminating the Opiate was actually this book, or actually this maybe two books by Rabbi Antelman. The opiate meant religion. And what these books are exposing are the plans to basically control the world. But first, one has to eliminate people's conscience and people's understanding of right and wrong. And once one successfully gets people to vacate their moral center, then it becomes far easier to control them. Because a person who knows right from wrong and a person who acts on that perception is far more difficult to control than somebody who's simply an amoeba and forms them, you know, adapts to whatever environment, whatever the environment dictates.
Well, of course, Janet, if you've studied, and I'm sure you're well aware of what's going on in our schools today, but they have programs already, of course, that are aimed at values clarification, and where the child has to decide who's going to get thrown out of the lifeboat. There's only room for six people, and there are eight people there. They're going to decide who lives, who dies. We are teaching our children today that there is no right, there is no wrong. They're the determinant of what is right and wrong. The DARE program that we give our children in schools to teach them whether, you know, about the use of drugs, they're to decide whether they're going to use drugs or not. What child, 14 or 15 years of age, is able to make adult decisions if they have no moral foundation? And then we wonder why a generation later, why we have a society without moral foundation, and we can attribute it directly to values clarification is being taught in schools today. Where there are no values, there is no right, there is no wrong, there are no absolutes, anything goes. Do what thou wilt. That is the whole of the law.
Well, one of the interesting things that we're seeing in the guardianships and conservatorships is that there are laws on the books which should protect the elderly. In California, for example, an elderly person has the right to a jury trial for their conservatorship, which takes it a step away from the judge. And we are seeing where the judges are becoming very, very corrupt. But we have incidences now where the judges are ignoring the law and violating the elderly person's right to a jury trial and simply refusing to allow them a jury trial. That way, ensuring that they will be ripped off of their assets, lose everything they've worked for, you know, which will go to pad the pocket of the conservator and her attorney. So it has become a very, very thorny situation. The laws are being broken regularly now in these conservatorship courts. And I have been reporting on this issue now for some time, and I am aware of dozens and dozens of stories. In fact, some groups have conference calls now. Guardianship victims have conference calls, and it always boils down to this perception that judges are breaking the law.
And, of course, what do you do when you have immoral judges? Of course, you cannot have a moral society without a moral foundation. And, of course, how do you get moral judges when they've been taught in all the time in grammar school that there is no right, there is no wrong? And I will tell you, I've gone for a jury of duty, and the judge would tell you, we don't want you to know the law. I will tell you what's right and wrong. I don't want you to go to the law library. You will do what I say. Is there anybody here now in this jury pool who won't go along with what I say? And I'm sitting there, I'm wondering, wait a minute, you're supposed to be interpreting the law. You're not supposed to be making the law. But this is the way that it is, and if you aren't willing to go along with the judge, he'll determine what's going to happen in that trial, and if you don't want to go along with it, don't be on the jury. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Janet Phelan. We're simply talking about the very real problem we have in a society that's turned its back on morality. Go right ahead, Janet.
Right. Well, one of the points that needs to be made here for the listening audience is all of us, God willing, will be old someday. And if you're not old, you probably have parents who may be getting old. So this is an issue that will impact everyone in this country in some way or another. Many years ago, there was this movie, Soylent Green, where some people in the society, I guess they were killing them, and then, well, it's pretty awful. I don't even want to go into, you know, what the Soylent Green really was, but what we have here is basically Soylent Green is their money, because they're treating people like cash cows, and if they end up dead in a hospice scam, or if they end up being deprived of antibiotics at the point of extreme illness, then it's simply more money for those who are supposedly guarding them. And what we see really is an upside down. Not only is morality being vacated, but it's upside down. A guardian is someone who's supposed to protect you, who isn't supposed to pillage and plunder and kill. But this is what we're seeing here. Now, I wanted to read a moment from Probate Murders Part 2, and this relates again to the judges. And this is actually a quote here. This was the Elizabeth case, and what had happened in this woman's case is that her conservator had signed a do not resuscitate order. Nowhere does the conservatee, Elizabeth, nowhere does her name appear on the do not resuscitate order, which I was able to pull up out of the court file. And so what the judge was writing here in his decision, and his decision happened because this Elizabeth had a daughter named Mary Beth who was appalled at what happened. And Mary Beth took all the medical records, put them into the court file, and was asking for some justice here. And here is what he wrote. Apparently, shortly, and I'm reading from his own file, so I guess I can, the names here. Apparently, shortly after Ms. Scott became the conservator, the conservatee had requested...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Janet. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Janet's simply telling the story of this one conservator who actually, of course, had put a do not resuscitate order on the someone she was looking after, and the woman's daughter was very upset that their mother went to the hospital and they didn't try to resuscitate her, something, whatever came up, and of course she took the case to court. I mean, what right did the conservator say to not resuscitate for her mother? And I don't know the circumstances of her mother's illness at all, but anyway, of course the conservator now is, this case has gone to court, and the judge, what did the judge say?
Right, and I'm reading here. I will read from his decision. Apparently, shortly after Ms. Scott became the conservator, the conservatee had requested a do not resuscitate order. Ms. Scott's notes reflect that the conservatee had the capacity to make such a decision. The children all testified that they did not know their mother had made such a request. In fact, they were adamant that their mother had expressed to them just the opposite. And this is the woman who came down with pneumonia and died for lack of antibiotics. Now, this particular woman was under an LPS conservatorship. That's Lanterman-Petrie Short in California. That's for people who have mental illness. So she was not only elderly, she had been diagnosed with mental illness. So even though the do not resuscitate order does not have this woman's name on it, the judge here is basically granting that she must have requested it, even though there's no indication she did. Second of all, he's stating that the conservator, Ms. Scott's notes reflect that the conservatee had the capacity to make such a decision. You have a woman who is under conservatorship because she has been adjudicated mentally ill. She's also elderly, in her 80s, and the judge is saying, reversing the entire scenario of lack of capacity and saying she has the capacity to request a do not resuscitate order.
But you have to understand, Janet, there really are people out there who relish actually doing people in. I mean, there are psychopathic people who, you know, once in a position of power, we saw this in Nazi Germany, why would we not expect we'd have people like that here in the United States? You know, would really not value human life at all.
Well, there seems to be something in the culture right now that really does encourage sociopathy. And it seems to have gotten into the culture and to have been buttressed by an awful lot of cultural factors. I remember back, I think it was in the 70s, late 70s, I believe it was Christopher Lash wrote a book called The Culture of Narcissism, which was my first introduction to understanding how a culture can actually encourage these sorts of behaviors. And yes, what we're seeing is where sociopathy and narcissism, which is, you know, basically a self-oriented life, where what's primary is what buttresses and enriches yourself. We're seeing where this is becoming more and more prevalent. Interestingly enough, I'm now in the Southern Oregon area. I've been here for a little over a year, and I had the opportunity to go to talk to a naturopath who does live blood analysis. And he, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but more and more naturopaths are doing that, and they take a little drop of your blood and look at it under a microscope and can tell if you have iron deficiencies and all parasites, all kinds of things. Well, this particular gentleman who's been doing live blood analysis over 30 years confided in me that he is seeing something, he's not even sure what it is, in people's, you know, something organically has changed. And he says he is seeing it more and more in the last 7 or 8 years, where there is something in the blood that he never saw before. And I joked. I mean, I just, you know, I have my own perceptions about things, and I just sort of shot off, you know, the cuff, oh, well, that's the sociopathy showing up in the blood. And I said, well, you're not going to find it in mine. And he actually, whatever this stuff is, and he says it looks like golden globes and little packs of strange cells, it didn't show up in mine. But he did tell me that it's becoming more and more prevalent, and he doesn't know what it is. But we're seeing things in the culture that are almost defy belief, and we don't know what they are.
Well, of course, the previous hour we had a doctor on just talking about the toxic metals that we're introducing into our people, and of course they get into the brain and they do alter behavior. Certainly, there's an inner area where they're fluoridating water with hydrofluorosilicic salicylic acid. The incidence of the level of lead doubles when the blood of children goes up 6 times in black children, only doubles in white children, and of course this of course affects their whole outlook. This is why rage, anger, hostility, criminal behavior is, so, in my opinion, so much more prevalent in the black. But, of course, not only that, it's the aluminum, it's the fluoride, it's the mercury. They're introducing in shots in the water. We're poisoning our people. And, of course, should we be surprised when we're poisoning our people with toxins that affect the brain, that we're getting abnormal sense of values and activity? This is not imaginary. This is really very real.
One of the things that I found out recently, which I'm sure you probably know quite a bit more about than I do, is the prevalence of some sort of fluoride compound in a lot of the psychiatric medicines that are being given to people, including that infamous Prozac.
Right.
So we have become a very we've become a psychiatric population, and Many people, you know, at the sign of distress will go running to a doctor and end up with antidepressants, anxiety drugs, all of which, many of which, may have even more fluoride than what they're already getting in their water. And
in fact, the fluoride is really the active ingredient in so many of the SSRI drugs. So.
Right. Right, exactly. So here we are, you know. the interesting thing I think about human beings is that we are definitely in corporeal form, but we do have this thing called a soul. But it seems to be somehow tweakable through our corporal self, so that if you have someone, you know, and you feed them enough poisons, enough fluoride, enough, you know, inappropriate medicines, you may be able to get them to start making decisions which they, at one point in time, they knew were wrong.
And, of course, the other thing is that what we're teaching our children in school, and that is there are no right values, there is no right, there is no wrong. You are the determinant of what's right and wrong. And, well, of course, in a materialistic society, you tell people that, and should we be surprised that they're materialistic? I think that sometimes we have people that are educated far beyond their intelligence. They have all sorts of degrees from the university, but they have lost touch with humanity. But anyway, go ahead.
Well,
so what's the solution, Janet? You've put this problem out. I think it's an excellent subject. I agree with you totally. But how do we remedy this situation? More laws? Should we pass more laws? Get government involved all the more? And if these things are really because of corrupt people, why should we think that the people in government would be any less corrupt than the people in the, that they're regulating?
Well, see, this is one of the issues. This is a very, very serious issue. Recently, I was contacted by a woman who is now a national delegate to the Democratic National Convention. And this woman became first a volunteer and then worked her way up to delegate status precisely because she wanted to be able to impact and make a difference about this elderly guardianship issue. And a very hard-working woman, very bright woman, and got herself selected as a national delegate. And she pulled together a national task force among people who had been victimized by this, or had loved ones victimized by this guardianship process. And she very, very quickly and very brilliantly put together I believe it's a 57-page document. It states, you know, what the problem is, what, you know, does sort of an analysis of the contributing issues. There are some recommendations towards oversight committees to look over what judges are doing, and these oversight committees should not be government people primarily, but citizens. Well, an interesting thing happened on the way to the DNC, because after putting together this document, which was buttressed by maybe 15 or so heart-wrenching stories of people who had watched their loved ones just be ripped apart through this process, this was sent to the person to distribute this appropriately to the platform committee. But it didn't get distributed. I believe two copies went out. There's, you know, many, many, I believe, over 100 people on the platform committee. And this went out to two people, the very top leadership. Now, Senator Obama had made a call to the American people saying, we want you to write the platform. You know, we want your input. And this woman took this to heart. And she did an amazing job at pulling people together, getting input, and putting together an amazing document, which did not get appropriately distributed. So once again, we see where there are programs that may have been really sanctioned by the highest level of power. If people speak up and begin to try to address these issues, there will be gatekeeper activity to keep this suppressed. We have seen this really in the mainstream media very strongly in terms of this guardianship issue. Just very briefly, the Los Angeles Times back in, I believe it was 2004 or 5, 2005, I believe, ran a multi-part series called Guardians for Profit: When a Family Matter Turns into a Business. And I had been interfacing with the lead reporter for that article. And I knew an awful lot of what she, with the skinny on what she really had. And when I saw what made the paper on this, I mean, this was watered down almost to gruel. Not only that, Robin Fields, the lead reporter on it, had told me that this was ready to go in 2003. It didn't even get published until 2005. So what we see again is where the gatekeepers, and we know how corrupt the press has become, but this is almost a shining example of that, where they've got a hot story, they sit on it, and then they water it down, and then they say, well, we did an expose. The article that appeared in the American Bulletin concerning this was attached to Probate Murders Part 1, and it was called Who Bought the Free Press? And it just goes through several instances where the press has been presented with the real meat of this conservatorship story and either misreports it or simply turns an entirely blind eye to it. And well, this is why it is so important what you're doing, Dr. Montes, you know, to put these stories out that the mainstream media is not addressing so that people can know what's happening. Because if we don't know what's happening in our own country, we won't be able to change it. And we may very well get blindsided if we don't know.
Well, I think, of course, that's why what you do, what I do, what people all across the country are doing in alternative radio, certainly, and we have the opportunity through radio, through satellite, and a lot of people are getting their satellites now where they can pull down programming, you know, of alternative radio through shortwave, through the Internet. And we have so many means of reaching people today, and you at least get them to understand there's a problem by radio programs. And then once they understand there's a problem, hopefully they'll start to read, because reading is the way you really can develop the ideas. But they're never even going to want to read until they know there's a problem. I know this is the way I was. You know, all through my years of training, I hadn't read a book or a magazine or anything. I was just totally dedicated to my studies. And it wasn't until 1962 when I realized that there was a problem or there might be a problem, I started to read. What you are doing, Janet, and with your investigative work, is pointing people in a direction. And then, hopefully, when enough people begin to understand, things are going to change. And certainly, we've noticed this in the areas where we do have a good outreach. I wish we had a lot more of an outreach. But we know that in specific areas where we blanket the region, that people's attitude, at least the attitude of many people, changes. So I applaud you for what you're doing as well.
Oh, thank you so very much. It's we're living in very interesting times, and I believe that's the Chinese curse, is it not? May you live in interesting times.
Right.
One of the things I want to be able to point out here is that we're dealing more than judicial corruption. It does appear that there are point people in almost every organization that is there established to protect the elderly, who are simply sidestepping the laws and going ahead to make sure that these terrible conservatorships, which many of which are basically robbing and even, you know, resulting in the untimely death of the conservatives, making sure that they go through. I have Adult Protective Services down in Southern California, basically refusing to go out on calls where some of these highly placed conservators are named as the perpetrators. Now, there is nothing in the APS guidelines or bylaws which allows them to discriminate and not address issues where the conservator is considered the perpetrator. However, there appears to be like some kind of memo or some kind of internal understanding that crimes being committed by some of these conservators and attorneys just simply get whitewashed. We have a situation going on in some of the district attorney's offices, a couple that I've been able to pinpoint having to do with San Bernardino and Riverside particularly, where if complaints come in with these embedded and highly placed conservators and attorneys named as possibly involved in criminal action, the reports get buried. They do not get investigated. Similarly with police.
Well, it's unfortunately, but sometimes we do have corruption. It goes to every level of society. And this is why, of course, we have to return to a moral foundation. America was corrupt back in the 1720s, 1710s. It really wasn't until about 1730 we had the first Great Awakening. America was corrupt in the early 1800s. It wasn't until we had the second Great Awakening in the 1830s, 1840s. Maybe that's what we need again. Well, Jen, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for putting me on the air about this, and I would like to encourage the listening audience to go into Google and read the probate murders.
Do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out? Telephone number?
Well, these are on supremelaw.org. You go to www.supremelaw.org, you will find several articles in the series of the probate murders. And if you would like to contact me directly about this, if you have had experience with this, or if you have had questions about this, you may email me at this address, 2.ifbyc, and 2 is spelled out, two.ifbyc@yahoo.com. And that is the name of my show on Republic Broadcast Network. On Saturdays, my co-host is Dr. Rebecca Carley. And please do listen in this Saturday. We're going to be discussing this at some length this Saturday, noon Pacific time. And we'll be taking call-ins as well.
Now, do you have affiliate stations? Do you have internet shortwave? How is the feed disseminated?
Republic Broadcasting Network goes out over republicbroadcasting.org. I understand there are also affiliate stations. I also broadcast a separate show on KSKQ, which airs in Ashland, Oregon, 94.9 on the FM dial, also streams kskq.org. And the name of that show is One If By Land. So we have One If By Land on KSKQ and Two If By C on Republic Broadcasting. And that does relate to Paul Revere's ride. We are trying to warn people about what our country is about and how best to protect them.
Well, I just hope and pray that your efforts and the efforts of so many people out across the country talking of these issues will make people understand there's a problem, and then, of course, we have to start looking for the solutions. But that's a subject for another evening. Anyway, God bless you, Janet. Thank you so very much for being with us, and we look forward to having you back again sometime. Maybe we could talk about the water issues, because I think the water issue is so vitally important. And, of course, it fits right into some of the other things we keep talking about, and that would be the weather modification programs, which are not imaginary. They're really very real. Good night. God bless.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and, of course, I hope you enjoyed our interview this evening with Janet Palin. And, of course, I think Janet's on the front lines of this battle, feeling very deeply about what's going on and wondering how we're going to approach this. Well, of course, the problem we have, it really is a moral problem. I mean, we can talk about it politically. We can talk about it ideologically. We can talk about it culturally and financially, but it's a moral problem. And it has to do with man's relationship to God. And once, of course, we lose that foundation, why, of course, anything goes. And this is the tragedy of what's going on today. But it did not happen by accident. It happened because the seminaries where our ministers have been trained, and the seminaries where the priests, Catholic priests, have been trained, have been infiltrated by people who have a different worldview, who have a different agenda. It is because our school and our school programs reflect the teaching of the teachers' colleges that have been infiltrated by people who have a different worldview. What is that worldview? Well, let me suggest we have a wonderful four-tape set of my interviews with Constance Cumby. And, of course, it's available, four-tape, four-CD set. Constance, is the person who really made me aware of the fact that there are people who are in touch with another dimension. You need to get the DVD of Constance. It's called The Emergence, and it's based really a summary of her experience as she began suddenly discovering this other dimension, the people who are involved with the other dimension. Then, of course, if you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, shame on you. You need to get that. You need to get the DVD that goes with that, or get the book. Basically, the book came from the talk, which is recorded on the DVD. You need to understand the Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to understand that an understanding of the forces that shape the events of the 20th century is predicated not upon facts to be learned, but rather upon secrets to be discovered. An understanding of the forces that shape the 20th century is predicated not upon facts to be learned, but rather upon secrets to be discovered. And that takes you into my talk on the forbidden secret. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really is a secret that's been passed down for 5,000 years. And, of course, it's not been readily available, not talked about until very recently. If you haven't seen the wonderful DVD Chris Pitto did called The Secret Riddle of America's, it's called Riddles in Stone, the secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. Let me recommend that to you, because there you'll hear some people from the Masonic lodges, Masonic organizations, leading Masons, just saying, well, you know, we could never have discussed these things 50 years ago. What sort of things couldn't they discuss? Why, their ability to be in contact with the other dimension. And until you understand that there is another dimension, a spiritual dimension, you cannot understand anything going on today, which is why our material on the forbidden secret and on the secret knowledge is so vitally important today. Our telephone number, if you'd like to get them, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, Constance Cumby's four-tape or four-CD set, and her DVD, The Emergence, and, of course, who is going to emerge? Well, then, of course, you would need to hear of the forbidden secret. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, of course, is radioliberty.com. We hope you'll go there. We hope you'll, of course, go to our section. We have a section called Other Videos. We have videos and other videos. Under Other Videos, why, of course, we had some of the most dramatic links up there, and you'd never guess what happened. They've all been disconnected. They've all just disappeared from the... But we still have them up there. Maybe someday they'll come back again, but we want you to go to my website, look under other videos, and there's some of them, of course, you can get, but all the YouTube have been just disconnected. Why? Well, I believe it's because they don't want you to know the truth. There's an organized effort to conceal the truth from the American people. That's radioliberty.com. Go up there and look under other videos. I go up and pursue Lindsay Williams' website. And you'll find he had to take it down. He was given an offer he couldn't refuse. There really are people out there who kill people who do not go along with the agenda.